ideology and worldview is long term. We know that they follow a very strict and rigid interpretation of Islam internally, but what is their foreign policy? Nobody knows that yet. I think the regional powers have to come together in some kind of summit beyond any geostrategic or geopolitical differences to try and get a handle on what's going on in Afghanistan and try and engage with the leadership of the Taliban. It seems to me that there is no resistance to the Taliban's advance domestically in Afghanistan at this juncture, as has already been said, that the Afghan government forces are collapsing like a house of cards. But beyond that, different ethnic groups in the north, what is their thinking? What is their future in Afghanistan that looks like it's going to be ruled by the Taliban from Kabul going forward? There's a lot of unknowns, but what we do know is that this is a withering indictment of US / Western foreign policy, and I hope that countries across the global south will understand that the future does not lie in the West, it lies in the East when it comes to stability and the future going forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. White. Now, Mr. Jones, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but this last question is really important. People are fleeing to Kabul, and now there's a fear of a looming humanitarian crisis, and food and fuel prices are rising. Will or can the international community do anything to alleviate the situation? We have less than 2 minutes left.
Well, they can. The question of will they do that, I think the basic thing is that these countries have got to come together. The U.S. has got to drop their hegemonic views and really talk with Russia, with China, with Pakistan, with Iran, with all the countries in the region, in order to create a situation to deal with this refugee crisis, one, and secondly, to try and create some kind of a relationship with whatever we have in Afghanistan when the dust settles.
Thank you very much, Mr. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review, and Mr. John White, writer and political commentator. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your views on this edition of The Spotlight, and thanks to you for following this edition.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, my deen. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. Thank you so very much for being with us. I am Zainab. Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Yes, he's my special co-host today, and we're totally excited to have him on the show because though the show is called Youth Station, bro, how old are you?
36.
Fine. That's fine.
I'm not that old.
Yeah, you're not that old at all. You're not even 40.
No, not yet.
And you're very much young at heart. Inshallah. I know that for a fact. So, yeah, this is going to be great. I thought today we'd talk about this concept that is revived every year. And it's turned into this sort of slogan for all of us. And how especially youth could relate to it, which is the slogan of Labbaik Ya Hussein. I mean, in like terminology wise, we all know what it means, though I'm not sure. What is the equivalent of Labbaik in English?
Labbaik is basically answering a call.
Right.
So if someone, like a call of assistance or any type of call. So you say like, to that call that you have made, obviously in very short words, mm-mm, I'm here. No, I'm here for you. You know, what is your command, basically, stuff like that.
Mm.
So it could.
It's like we do it in Hajj too, right? Labbaik Allahumma labbaik.
Yeah, I'm here. I've answered your call.
Exactly.
I've answered your invitation.
And it's so beautiful, the idea of, you know, thinking that Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam called out for each of us one by one, and we're like answering that call. But I feel like, I'm not gonna lie. For the longest time, I could never bring myself to relate to this term, Labbaik Ya Hussein, because I felt like it's such a huge responsibility to claim that, okay, I'm going to answer the call of my imam now. Like, what am I even doing?
I don't think you're alone in that. It's a heavy burden. I mean, first of all, we can say, you can put it in two ways. There's the verbal answering, which we all do, but it's the next step. You know, we have, okay, this is Youth Station, so I don't want to bring too many of these hadith and stuff into it. But like, when it comes to like iman, and to show a person's belief,
yeah.
You know, you have those three stages, with the tongue, with the limbs, with the heart.
Right.
So here you can use the same, that, you know, you first have to identify who the imam is, and then, you know, you claim that you, with your tongue at least, that you testified, okay, hopefully I will be there. And then finally, when you actually have that belief and that certainty in your heart, by obviously the actions that we do, because there's a relationship here obviously between that ma'rifah and that understanding and the actions that we do, in order to truly get to know that, yes, when that call is eventually made, I will be there. And I remember just on this, a personal anecdote of myself. I'm sure you've been to the Haram of Muslim ibn Aqil in Kufa. Well, it is said to be the Zari of Muslim ibn Aqil anyway. Or even Imam Ali alayhi salam or Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas during the days of Ashura or Arba'in. And you see millions of people going in shouting Labbaik Ya Ali, or Labbaik Ya Abul Fadr, or Labbaik Ya Hussein, or Labbaik Ya Muslim. And especially Masjid al-Kufa, this kind of struck me, because obviously we know what happened in Masjid al-Kufa. And I sat down in the masjid just on a corner looking at this, and that particular incident when Muslim was left alone came to mind. It's like those people also said Labbaik. And now how many of us, when the time actually comes, will we actually truly put that verbal call into action?
Exactly. Like how many of us is actually going to show up, you know, and own that situation? You know, it's so easy, especially during Muharram and Safar, for us to get sentimental. You know, I think it just applies to almost every Shia in the whole world, that when it comes to Muharram, that atmosphere and that level of spirituality and that level of emotional attachment we have to our imam kind of inspires us to in a way to like, and especially when we're listening to all the eulogies about what happened to him and the hardships he had to go through, we're like, oh my god, whatever Imam Hussein wants, I'm totally gonna do it for him, I'm totally gonna give it for him, I'm gonna give him my life, I'm gonna change my life for him. And during those few weeks, and which I think is a really good thing, I mean, obviously, the barakah is gonna carry out.
It shows that there is something good within our essence somewhere.
Yeah, there's we've got potential, good. Right?
There's something good.
Exactly. Yeah. And, but then after that, after Muharram and Safar is over, it's like the holy month of Ramadan, you kind of start to lose that momentum and you get distracted again by everyday life and everything falls back into its normal routine again. And
we take the first chance to sin again.
And I'm like, where does that Labbaik go? Where does it go? What happened to that Labbaik? All over again from your own experience. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
Labbaik ya Hussein, labbaik ya Hussein, labbaik ya Hussein, ya Rasulullah. Labbaik ya Hussein, labbaik ya Hussein, labbaik ya Hussein,
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab, and my co-host is Brother Yasser today. I want you to like look back at your own experience with this term, Labbaik Ya Hussein, from when you were younger, and how you developed, how you personalized it for yourself.
First of all, became acquainted with the story when I first went to the UK. So during my early youth, to say, early teens, till about 16, there was nothing about Imam Hussein that really related to me, because we weren't in an environment, or there wasn't anything like that. So when I went to the UK and I got to know my Shia side of the family, let's put it that way, because my mom is Shia.
So in South
Africa, we grew up Hanafi until I went to the UK, and I started my journey of self-reflection, if you like to call it that. And it was the first time I came to know about Muharram, about the story. And, you know, it struck, like, why weren't we taught this in school, or in the what do we call it, the afternoon schools that we went to, the Islamic school that we went to in the afternoon, the madrasa. And why weren't we told this, and so on and so forth. And then research happened and so on. And it's funny that it wasn't only, like, me as a youth at that time, and you see that people who are scholars, who are themselves like, okay, why do we not know this? Why was this not told to us? Why was it hidden from us? And so on and so forth. So you made your research and so on. So my first Muharram experience was actually then. And it was also, you know, quite unclear what was actually happening to myself personally.
For sure.
Especially in a subcontinent, Indo-Pak. At that time in the UK, it was mainly Urdu lectures, right? So my family would go and, okay, go with them. And then after, you'd obviously see the Noha and the Matam and the... And in some places you'll have the zanjir. Before we say zanjir is haram, according to me, and just put it out there right now because of the verdict of Sayyid Khamenei and Imam.
Did y'all hear that? Only on Youth Station. Yeah.
So we went, and the first time I saw this, and I'm thinking to myself, what is going on? So I was like, actually my cousins were walking past me. So my cousins were smiling at me and said, you know, be prepared. I'm like, for what? What's going to happen? So my cousins were...
Brace yourself.
I had to brace myself. They were walking past me to go out. My cousins were actually leaving. My first cousin. I got quite close to my cousins and stuff.
Mm-mm.
So they were leaving. So the majlis had finished. Then matam had finished. Mm. So now it was time for the extra matam. So they were leaving. Mm. And they're looking at me smiling. I'm like, okay, what's happening? I said, no, be careful even though. I'm like, for what? So they were walking, and I stood there, and I saw it. The first time I saw it. It was like my first Muharram as well, and I saw this.
Did you freak out?
I didn't, actually.
Seriously?
I didn't. So I was like, no, something inside was like, okay, these people need support or whatever. So I stayed there, and I tried to, you know, support them, but I didn't really understand why I was supporting them. And after a while, obviously learning and reading and so on and so forth, I came to understand a bit more. And then, you know...
Did it not throw you off? Did it not make you feel like, ew, what are you guys doing?
It didn't, actually. It was funny enough, it didn't. I mean, a lot of people, it does.
Yeah.
It puts them off. But for me, it wasn't. I think it was maybe...
How long before this event of Muharram did you become introduced to the concept of Ashura?
I didn't become introduced to the concept of Ashura. I became introduced to the concept of Tashayyu first. What is the difference? Because in Africa at that time, there wasn't really... a difference known. It was everybody was Muslim and so on until later after the revolution and so on, and with the influx of Wahhabi ideology, did this kind of split happen, because the Sunnis in Africa also would commemorate Muharram.
Oh, beautiful!
But we did not know about it because the school that we went to were more Wahhabi Salafi orientated. But we didn't know about it, and they never spoke about it, so it wasn't really. But there were Sunni masajids would. You know, commemorate Ashura, would commemorate Muharram. But we didn't know about it until I went to England, came back, and then I saw these things. But now, alhamdulillah, it's more open with obviously social media, advertising, and so on.
Yeah.
More of it is out there.
Definitely. But when did you feel like, okay, Labbeke Ya Hussein clicked for you? Because for me, it happened very recently.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things maybe was when I was at university.
Where did you study, bro?
Where?
What?
Oh, sports science.
How did you end up here?
That's where it kind of happened. Like, it was during the one of the majlis, and it kind of came like... Basically, the majlis that were in English were very new at that time. They were very... I'm talking about...
About
18 years ago. 18 years ago.
Circa 1822.
About 18 years ago. So there were very few English speakers. The majalis was, you know, obviously not as academic as you would like. So the speakers always, there were good speakers, some of them, but they were very motivational speakers at that time, at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, okay, how much can I get from this mimbar? How much can the speaker or this pulpit really give me, or what Islam really is?
Yeah, for real. Yeah.
So therefore, when he decided, okay, look, one of the duties is to kind of learn. One of the things was like, let's go and find religion, what religion is.
Yeah.
And I think it was then where that Labbaik actually came.
That's beautiful.
Where you came and you said, okay, how am I going to serve this message?
Yeah. Oh, that is so hardcore. Because that's like the reality of Labbaik.
So how are you going to serve the message? Basically study as much as you can.
Mm.
Hopefully you learn something.
Hopefully.
And then take it back.
Take it back. Beautiful.
That was the way it kind of happened. Sometime at university. Somewhere. Actually, also before university, before that. So again, let's go back. 15 years. This is happening, I think, 2005. Yes. 2005 was the first time I came to Iran. It was with a group called Al-Asr. And it really changed my life as well. But we saw... what Shiism in a Shia country actually meant, and these type of things. Well, we came in the month of Rajab, and it's one of the best things that we... So it was month of Rajab, was the birthday of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Oh, beautiful.
So that week of the birthday of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Sayyid Khamenei, Sayyid Al-Qaid was giving Jum'ah in Tehran, and we had front row seats. Basically, that was also like an opening. I already had this intention of studying before then, so that kind of wanted to come, this kind of... affirmed it.
Yeah.
I made it stronger to come. But I finished my university.
Okay, thank God for that. The man got his degree.
Yeah,
come on, everybody chill.
And then I came.
Alhamdulillah, mashallah, that's great. And that basically, I think to myself that, yeah, Labbayka Ya Hussein has been the same thing for me. It means that, Ya Aba Abdullah, this here is what I'm going to do to get closer to you.
Yeah.
This is Labbayk. That's all the time we have for today. That was an interesting discussion. Thank you so very much for being with us, you guys. And until another episode of Youth Station, I leave you all in the care and protection of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei, has highlighted the unreliability of foreign providers of COVID vaccines to Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei said foreign providers of the vaccines initially reneged on their promises and refused sales, but things began to change course after Iran successfully managed to produce jabs against the deadly virus at home. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks during a televised speech on Wednesday amid a deadly pandemic wave that has gripped the country. Fortunately, the production of vaccines within the country paved the path for the import of foreign shots as well, whereas before that, foreign suppliers would renege on their promises despite having received the payments. The leader called on the executive bodies to double their efforts to procure vaccines, whether imported or domestically developed, and made them available to everyone.
We always have to look to the source of problems in the Middle East, and that is usually either the United States or Israel. In this case, I think we can see, or say fairly safely, that the United States pressured other countries not to sell vaccines to Iran in order to pressure Iran to re-enter the JCPOA. This is going to be a failed strategy, really a failed strategy by the United States, which has never understood people's loyalty to their own government and has tried to bribe or intimidate countries to do the United States' bidding.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed an initiative by President Ebrahim Raisi to set a one-week deadline for proposals on a comprehensive national response to the current peak of the outbreak. He said the response to the issue should be carefully weighed and any necessary measures adopted and enforced accordingly.
This is another example of that. By preventing other countries from selling vaccines to Iran, U.S. hopes that Iran will agree to concessions to rejoin the JCPOA. This simply isn't going to happen.
Iran is one of the few countries which has been able to produce vaccines against the deadly COVID virus. After a year of intensive research using all internal resources and expertise, Iran joined the handful of countries that produced the coronavirus vaccine. The Ministry of Health later approved the Coviran Barakat vaccine that was jointly developed by Barakat Pharmaceutical Group and Shifa Pharmed Industrial Group. Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine has hit a production milestone of 5 million doses nearly a month after it was approved for emergency use in the country. Iran has accelerated its inoculation drive against the coronavirus since earlier this month after the health ministry announced that it can rely on abundant supplies of foreign jabs as well as regular deliveries of vaccines that are being manufactured inside of Iran. The government says that it is determined to launch the production lot of domestic jabs, but stresses that vaccines must be imported from other countries to save people's lives. Knowledge-based companies, and especially those active in nanotechnology, are playing a major role in helping the vaccine production companies.
This is definitely an example of that, where U.S. sanctions once again have injured innocent people. We remember back in the early part of the millennium when Madeleine Albright and Secretary of State was asked if the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children were worth U.S. sanctions. And she said, yes, it was. That's the U.S. attitude. The U.S. government does not care about the suffering of people.
Iran managed to produce vaccines despite being under cruel U.S. sanctions. The sanctions seriously undermined Iran's ability to battle the pandemic.
Iran could certainly have dealt with this pandemic much better than it was able to had the illegal and unjust sanctions not been issued. But Donald Trump issued them, violating international law and U.S. law by doing so, when he violated the JCPOA. And the United States once again has blood on its hands, this time blood of innocent Iranians who would have been able to get the vaccine had the sanctions not existed.
The cruel and illegal sanctions denied Iran access to crucial raw material and necessary equipment.
Controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces, despite its neutrality in the Second World War. The 1943 conference at the Russian embassy is seen by many Iranians as a violation of Iran's sovereignty and independence. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif led a chorus of sharp criticism, describing the photo as, quote, extremely inappropriate. On Thursday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British and Russian envoys over the release of the picture online. The envoys were told at the ministry that the posting was totally unacceptable. The Russian and British diplomats insist that no harm was intended and that the picture was a tribute to the fight against Nazi Germany. Other Iranian officials and people were quick to denounce the photo. Iran's Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf censored the meeting between the Russian and UK ambassadors as, quote, inappropriate and inconsistent with diplomatic protocols, urging the foreign ministry to follow up on the case. Ghalibaf said both ambassadors must swiftly issue an official apology, otherwise firm diplomatic action will be necessary. Foreign Minister Designate Hossein Amir Abdullahian joined the chorus of critics on Thursday. The top diplomat said the picture, quote, showed disregard for diplomatic etiquette and the national pride of the Iranian people. Faced with widespread criticism, the Russian ambassador tweeted that the photo does not have any anti-Iranian context. The envoy said that he is not going to offend the feelings of the friendly Iranian people. The British ambassador retweeted his Russian counterpart's comments. The controversy triggered by the photo is still under the spotlight. Some observers believe an official apology could help end the controversy.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States, and Canada, the unprecedented and deadly floods in Western Europe, the soaring temperatures across the world, and severe droughts elsewhere. These are all harbingers of a devastating climate crisis that is to come. The United Nations released its most comprehensive report on climate change yet on Monday. In the document, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said humans are to blame for the strange and tragic natural catastrophes the world is witnessing. The definite tone marked a contrast from the language used in previous reports, which had said industrial activity was extremely likely to blame. In a statement, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report a, quote, threat for humanity. The report was published less than 3 months before the United Nations Climate Change Conference 2021, which will be hosted by Scotland. IPCC findings are expected to feature prominently in the discussions.
I think it's too late to keep things as they were. What we have to do is figure out to moderate the influences of all this. And I don't think it's going to be a pretty sight.
The UN Climate Panel, IPCC, comprises thousands of scientists across 195 countries who compile peer-reviewed research articles about global warming into a report. This year's report was written by over 230 authors who have reviewed some 14,000 research papers. The IPCC report warns that even in the case of the sharpest cuts in emission, the world might not be able to maintain the global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Accord, adding that without immediate steep cuts, the average temperatures will soar past 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Moreover, according to the report, even if the world manages to cap global warming at the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, extreme weather conditions will continue to become more common and intense. A rise in sea levels also seems inevitable, as the report says even with the most severe cuts in carbon emissions, the melting of polar ice will elevate sea levels for hundreds or even thousands of years. All is not lost, however, as the IPCC suggests there is still time to prevent a worst-case scenario. The UN panel says the world has about a decade to decrease the rate at which it pumps carbon into the atmosphere before it's too late. Activists and politicians reacted to the findings with alarm.
We're not talking about the root cause itself, the things that is actually fueling these events. We are not holding people in power accountable. We are not talking about the current best available science, what it says, and how the situation looks like now. And we are especially not talking about the gap between what politicians are saying and what they are actually doing.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the IPCC report a wake-up call, while U.S. President Joe Biden called for action to fight climate change.
I think a lot of the people who have the power and the money have absolutely no idea how bad things are, because they simply refuse to admit it, and because they're still looking at short term and making more money this quarter and getting elected next time.
Many have so far shrugged off climate warnings and believe the concept of global warming and climate change to be a hoax. But now that there are more signs of climate change than ever before, will there be a universal consensus and will to counter the devastating impact we're exerting on the planet?
Iraq and Syria have been struggling with poverty and instability for years. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and Washington and its allies' support for opposition groups and al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, as well as crippling economic sanctions, merely added fuel to the fire of instability there and gave birth to Daesh. Since Daesh terrorists emerged in Iraq and Syria, Iran has been providing advisory assistance to the two countries' armies in their fight against the terrorists. On August 7, 2017, Daesh terrorists captured a member of an Iranian advisory support team in Syria near the Tamf border crossing in the southeast of the country. 2 days later, on August 9, Mohsen Hojaji was beheaded by the Takfiri terrorists. The terrorist group published photos and videos of Hojaji's arrest and beheading. The act prompted widespread condemnation of the terrorist group, as well as the admiration of the soldiers who were fighting against it. In a meeting with the family of Hojaji, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed Hojaji as an emblem of sincere and courageous martyrdom and called the Takfiri groups puppets of the United States and Britain. Also, late Iranian commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Qasem Soleimani, slammed the incident as a horrific, inhumane crime that came in the wake of successive blows dealt on several fronts to Takfiri Wahhabi terrorist groups, which are linked to the world's imperialist power. He vowed not to rest until they have taken out every last terrorist from the face of the Muslim world. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis who played a decisive role in the full-scale fight against the Daesh terrorists, were assassinated in Baghdad airport in January 2020 in a US drone attack. Two years after the 9/11 incident, the US invaded Iraq and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence that took the lives of over a million Iraqis and displaced over 9 million more. Consequently, the chaos that resulted from the US invasion finally gave birth to Daesh terror group in 2014. Elsewhere in Syria, the government has been grappled with foreign-backed militancy since March 2011, that later gave way to the presence of terrorist groups such as Daesh. Furthermore, over the past years, the US has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the US and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. The US has also been blamed for stealing and selling Syrian oil and other resources. Add to this list the crippling sanctions against the Damascus government. The US has targeted Baghdad and Damascus with crippling economic sanctions, which have worsened the socio-economic conditions there.
First of all, let's say Iran is supporting all the freedom fighters in the world and fighting against the terrorists. Even, you know, like we call it, either we call it the Hujaija massacre, brutal killing by ISIS, and then al-Nusra later on. As we know that those movements, let's say, or organizations, according to what Hillary Clinton said, this is they were all created by United States.
Washington is directly responsible for the emergence of Daesh and the current instability and poverty that has afflicted the Iraqi and Syrian nations. Ironically, the U.S. punishes countries that are aiding Baghdad and Damascus to fight the Takfiri terrorists with economic sanctions and calls them terrorists. Aren't the real terrorists those who provide assistance for Daesh and worsen the living conditions of people by imposing economic sanctions on their countries?
Hosseiniya. His Path from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bihi nasta'in.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
In the beginning, I should like to express my deepest, sincere condolences on the coming of the grief-stricken month of Muharram. This is another episode of the program Hosseiniya, in which we are going to review some aspects and some phrasings of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam throughout his movement from Medina to Mecca and from Mecca to Al-Kufa. When Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was leaving the city of Mecca, some people came to suggest him not to do so. Why? Because those who used to be among the companions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam had heard it from the Prophet that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam would certainly be martyred, and based on these frequent anticipations, everybody feared about the life and security of Imam al-Hussein salam. Yet the value of safeguarding the Islamic religion was regarded by Imam al-Hussein as-salam as being much more important than saving his own life. There was a person in Mecca by the name Abdullah ibn Zubayr. Abdullah ibn Zubayr suggested Imam al-Hussein as-salam to remain in Mecca and not to leave it. then Imam al-Hussein al-Salam answered him in this way. My father reported that there would be a ram at Mecca whose honor would be desecrated. Hence, I never liked to be that ram. And if I get slain out of it, that is out of Mecca, by a span, it's more desirable for me to get slain inside it. It means that the sanctity and security of Mecca shouldn't be violated. Why? Because Yazid had dispatched a secret army to Mecca in order to assassinate and kill Imam al-Hussein al-Salam during the Hajj rituals. And if I get slain out of it by two spans, it's more desirable to me than getting slain in it by a span. By Allah, had I been in the burrow of a small animal like these animals, they would draw me out until they do with me the job, that is to kill me. So we find that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam was well aware of the whole situation. Imam al-Hussein al-Salam was certainly aware that the Umayyads intended to kill him at any price. So, in order for the security and sanctity of Mecca not to be violated by shedding blood over there, Imam al-Hussein al-Salam determined to leave the city of Mecca. Why? Because Yazid had dispatched a secret army under Amr ibn Sa'id al-Ashdagh, who was the Umayyad governor of Mecca, to assassinate Imam al-Hussein al-Salam during the Hajj rituals. Since Mecca is a sacred city due to the presence of Al-Kaaba over there, and nobody should be killed over there, well, Yazid intended to kill Imam al-Hussein al-Salam over there in order to both kill Imam al-Hussein al-Salam and to show that he had no respect for the sanctity and security of Mecca. So it was the wisest decision that Imam al-Hussein al-Salam took in order to leave Mecca for the city of Al-Kufa, from where he had received around 12,000 letters of invitation. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, an IranSat or BAT5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Raytheon has close ties to the Israeli military and supplies them with missiles, bombs, and other equipment, including the Iron Dome system. Anti-war group said, adding, these weapons have been linked to dozens of attacks that have killed and injured civilians. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading Anti-War Group Blocks Entry to Raytheon Facility to Protest Killing of Civilians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Group of anti-war activists blockaded the entrances to a Raytheon facility in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, recently to protest the role the weapons maker plays in the killing of civilians in Yemen, the occupied Palestinian territories, and elsewhere around the world. The demonstration was organized and live-streamed on Facebook by Resist and Abolish the Military-Industrial Complex, RAMINC, and the FANC Collective, a direct action organization based in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. In a statement, the FANC Collective pointed to a 2018 CNN report revealing that Raytheon, the second largest military contractor in the world and the largest producer of guided missiles, manufactured bombs and other munitions that the U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition used to kill dozens of women, children, and other civilians in Yemen. The anti-war group said Raytheon also has ties to the Israeli military and supplies them with missiles, bombs, and other equipment, including the Iron Dome system. These weapons have been linked to dozens of attacks that have killed and injured civilians. Two protesters at the Portsmouth facility attached themselves to cars to obstruct the entrances as others chanted, "Shame on Raytheon," and held banners that read, "Raytheon profits from genocide." Police officers soon arrived on the scene and extracted at least one of the protesters from a car, towing it away. "Raytheon profits from the killing of civilians, families, and children in Palestine, Yemen, and elsewhere," one of the demonstrators said, adding, "We can't sit idly by. While Raytheon engineers new and more destructive ways of killing innocent people, Raytheon must be stopped and held accountable." 2015, the U.S.-backed Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and devastated the country, creating what the United Nations calls the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Half the country's people are on the brink of famine. The country has the world's worst cholera outbreak in recorded history, and now Yemen has one of the very worst COVID death rates in the world. It kills one in four people who test positive. American weapons manufacturers like Raytheon have a vested interest in continuing the war and wield an immense amount of power in Washington. It is unlikely the U.S. regime will end the war without a fight. Starting under Obama and continuing under Trump and Biden, the U.S. have been heavily involved in the war on Yemen, primarily through weapon sales to Saudi Arabia regime and its coalition partners. These weapons are by and large used to intentionally target and kill Yemenis. This bloodthirsty logic has been a driving force behind the war for almost 6 years. Raytheon Technologies, the second largest arms manufacturer in the world, is one major provider of these weapons. It stands out from the rest of its competitors because of its close ties with Saudi Arabia regime, having been the first weapons manufacturer to build a permanent operation there in 1960s, hiring members of the Saudi royal family as consultants and opening a branch of the company in Riyadh in 2017. After the war began in March 2015, Raytheon's stock price went from about $108 to more than $180 in 2019, reflecting billions of dollars in weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Despite the countless threats connecting Raytheon to Saudi Arabia and its financial interest in the continuing war in Yemen, the company portrays itself as a neutral force, which simply carries out the foreign policy of the U.S. regime and therefore is not responsible for the destruction wrought by its weapons. When Vice President of Business Development and CEO of Raytheon Company International John D. Harris II was asked by the CNBC in a February 2019 interview about the use of Raytheon bombs in Yemen, his response was, "We are an element of U.S. policy. Our role is not to make policy. Our role is to comply with it." By characterizing itself as an obedient, law-abiding company, Raytheon not only attempts to weasel out of its culpability, but also obfuscates the horrific tragedy playing out in Yemen and other countries where its bombs fall.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Here at IRIB English Radio, we would like to express our condolences to you, our listeners, on the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions in this month of Muharram. Today we're going to be talking about the ziyarat and a homage of Ashura, which is a very important ziyarat from amongst the various ziyarats that we recite. Ziyarat and the homage and the visitation of Ashura. The first question that we want to ask regarding this ziyarat is, how reliable is it? How reliable and authentic is this ziyarat? The answer to this question is that the ziyarat Ashura is one of the most authentic, the oldest and most authentic text in which this ziyarat has been transmitted to us is a book called Kamilu's Ziyarat. The author of this book is a person named Jafar ibn Kulawaye Qumi. This person has related this and transmitted this ziyarat via five mediums from the fifth Imam, Imam Baqir alayhi salam. Therefore, we can say that this ziyarat has been related from Imam Baqir from five mediums in a very authentic book, and therefore it's a very reliable and authentic ziyarat that one can recite. The second question that we'd like to address regarding this ziyarat is that in this ziyarat we see that many of the enemies of the family of the Prophet alayhi wasalam have been cursed. Many people say that this cursing is something that's not suitable and not something that's not compatible with the lofty stature of the imams. So how is this reconcilable with the lofty stature of the imams? The imams were kind people, they were kind to everybody, and they were very merciful and beneficent. So how can we how is it possible to reconcile these noble attributes with these with these curses that they send upon their enemies? The answer to this question is that these curses, the word lan in Arabic is a, it refers refers to the intention of distancing oneself from another person. When we perform a lan on somebody, we are in effect expressing our desire to be distant from that person or that individual. At the same time, when we and this is not something that is not incompatible with the stature of the imams. At the same time, we see that in the Holy Quran, God Almighty, 37 times he performs a lan or a curse upon various individuals and groups, such as the disbelievers, the kafirin, the polytheists, the mushrikeen, the liars, and others, the kadhibin. Right? So this act of cursing, it's not something that is incompatible with the stature of the Imam. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. We were examining the dimensions of the Ziyarat of Ashura. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding.